Pelagianism, Gnosticism, Valentinians, Corpocratians, Docetics, Montanists, Arianism, Modernism, the New Age. Throughout the ages have rocked the church. But the church has always fought back and won. Hear how next on Scandal of the Cross with Bob and Penny Lord.
Hello, family, and welcome. We're Bob and Penny Lord, and today we want to share with you the Muslim movement. The 6th century gave birth to the Muslim movement. The church had always been under attack. We had many enemies in the 7th century. Among them were Hindus and Buddhists. But there was another group which had not yet been accounted for because at the beginning of the 7th century they were not a big group. They were just germinating. The sons of Ishmael had scattered all throughout the Middle East and had become separate little splinter groups. Very individual, very self-centered little rulers of little kingdoms. Because of their individuality, they were very weak. They were completely ineffective as a people because they were not united.
A man with a vision was born into this society in Mecca in the year 570. His name was originally Mahomet, but was later changed to Mohammed. He was a simple man of simple background, a camel driver. He never learned to read or write, but that was not unusual in those days. But he was brilliant. He belonged to one of the many nomadic tribes which the Romans never thought worthwhile conquering. Mohammed did not initially set out to start a religion. Actually, he was intrigued by the tales of the Christians he heard from camel drivers and passing caravans. He used to listen to the Jews and Christians in the marketplace. He was fascinated with their philosophy, but he knew he would have to simplify it for his people. They would never understand it. He spent a lot of time thinking. He couldn't read, but he could dream. He said he had a vision from an angel, the angel Gabriel, who taught him how to read. Mohammed claimed to have received the message from the angel. He went home and told his wife. She encouraged him to go back to the foothills to see if the angel had anything else to say to him. So Mohammed went, and he said the angel continued to speak to him. This was beginning to be exciting for Mohammed. Now the thought came to him that he might actually be a prophet. He claimed the angel gave him the religion he projected to his people, the religion which ultimately united them, and it was, believe what you want, what you don't like, throw out.
It was a very simple religion. He began to teach the first real group of followers, give up idolatry. Do not steal, do not lie, do not slander, and never become intoxicated. He called his new religion Islam, which means the acceptation of Allah, who is God. He called his flock Muslims, which means true believers. Mohammed created a lifestyle, a way of life. If a brother owed a sum of money, as long as he submitted, became a follower of Islam and Allah, his debt was forgiven. Don't ask me what happened to the one to whom he owed the debt. He was out of luck, or so it would seem. But there was an outrageous epidemic of usury, lending money at extremely high rates of interest, so that most people could never even make the interest payments, much less the principal. This had spread throughout the world, and we believe Mohammed or his family might have been victimized by this evil practice at a given point in his life. Only one thing was for sure. The Arabs were ripe for a prophet and a religion. They were wandering around aimlessly, and the answer was to mimic Christianity.
The religion we know today as Islam evolved more than anything else. It's loosely based on Christianity and Judaism, and some holdover beliefs from the old Arab rites. Mohammed paid close attention to the teachings of the popular religions of his time. Christianity was the newest and most popular. It had spread like wildfire throughout the world. Why not take from Christianity and use it for his design of a new religion. This is exactly what Muhammad did. He created a doctrine based on a distortion of the Catholic faith. For example, Muhammad taught there was one God, his name was Allah. Allah was all-powerful. Allah was all-circumspect. Allah was all-good. Allah is the creator of all things. All things exist through the power of Allah. Allah has always existed and will always exist. Angels do the bidding of Allah. Man's soul was immortal. There was a heaven and hell. Those who followed Allah would be rewarded. The enemies of Allah would be punished. Islam had its own version of the Bible, the Quran. Moses was a prophet. Elijah was a prophet. Mary was blessed among all women. She may have been born without sin, was their thinking. John the Baptist and Jesus were prophets. They could not accept that Jesus was Lord.
There are a few areas here we would have to dispute. For instance, Allah was all good. We know from present Islam beliefs that a man who kills his enemy goes to heaven, and a man who dies in defense of Islam goes to heaven immediately. To encourage killing of one's enemies does not sound like a God who is good, or with whom we would want to be associated. In addition, Muhammad said, "I, last of the prophets, am sent with a sword." The sword is the key to heaven and hell, and all who draw it in the name of the faith will be rewarded. However, if we were to not look carefully at everything listed above, we might say that Islam was close to Christianity, until you get to the last line. But these were the things that Muhammad chose to take from Christianity in order to form a strong, solid, credible base. The dogmas of our faith, which he threw out, are like huge, gaping stab wounds at the heart of our religion. Followers of Muhammad, the Muslims, have some firm beliefs which are irreconcilable with Christianity, such as, Jesus was born of human estate. Jesus cannot be God. God cannot die. Jesus died. Therefore, he cannot be God. The incarnation of Jesus, his death on the cross for our salvation, all of this was just too difficult to understand, so scrap it. In addition, he was not trying to become a Christian. He was trying to build a workable theology to become the leader of his people.
Unfortunately, when he discarded the incarnation of Jesus, he had to throw out a few more tenets of our religion, one of which, there is no Trinity. There is only one God with three individual persons who still remained one God, was too much to accept. Scrap it. The Mass was a reenactment of the crucifixion, death, and resurrection of Jesus. God could not die, they said. If he could not die, he could not resurrect. It glorified the triune God in the creed, which, according to Muhammad, didn't exist. The Mass had to go. The Eucharist, wow, the Eucharist was beyond their human understanding. It was, as well, the acceptance of Jesus as God. They believed he was only a prophet. Throw it out. There was no need for the priesthood. If there was no Mass and no Eucharist, why would they need priests? Muhammad contended that all these areas of our faith that he couldn't understand or agree with were created by priests so that they would have power over the people. With an exclusive job that no one else could do, you couldn't have a religion without them. That would give them very individual powers, which Muhammad didn't think were necessary or wise. He eliminated them.
After Muhammad stripped away all the things he didn't like or understand and put in all the things he did like, he used that as a foundation to actually shape and mold a religion based on his own background, trials and tribulations, one that he and his people could live with. Above all things, he strove for simplicity in his dogma. Don't make it too hard. Keep it simple. Now, can you really believe that the Archangel Gabriel gave all of this to Muhammad? Having researched and written a book on the heavenly army of angels, we have a great difficulty accepting Muhammad's claim that it was the angel Gabriel who spoke to him. Can you believe that the angel Gabriel would disavow his God, his Jesus? Could the same angel Gabriel who announced to Mary that she would give birth to the Messiah, who said, "Hail Mary, full of grace," then contradict himself by telling Muhammad she was not a virgin? with the same angel Gabriel who spent all that time with his beloved Mary, guarded the Holy Family, who was beside his Lord during the entire period of Jesus' life on earth, then renounced his divinity to a camel driver in the Middle East 500 years later? It just doesn't make sense.
However, a curious but very interesting point is that both Mohammed and Joseph Smith, who began the Mormon cult, picked out the most convenient parts of the Old and New Testaments, claimed they were given them by a heavenly messenger, and started new religions, which suited their own lifestyles and wrote their own Bibles based on these teachings. There is a great deal of similarity between the experiences of Mohammed and Joseph Smith, as well as the tailor-made religions they put together, including the practice of polygamy, having more than one wife at a time. Not bad if you can do it, and they did it.
Mohammed had a very valid reason for putting together this loosely formed structure. He wanted to unite his people. It was as simple as that. His people, the Arabs, were living in an area of the world called Arabia, and they were spiritually bankrupt. They drank heavily, they gambled, they worshipped idols. They were completely self-centered, without ambition, which made them, for the most part, an embarrassment to the civilized world. In addition to being very ambitious, Mohammed sincerely became concerned for his people, especially the more he learned about Christianity and the rewards of the good life. He began preaching all throughout Mecca, his hometown, but he was not accepted because he was coming against the rich and the powerful.
He eventually left Mecca in disappointment and frustration. He tried to get his message across to the people of a small town about 70 miles away. But because his message attacked drinking, and the town was the center of a grape harvesting industry, he was almost killed. They ran him out of town, nearly stoning him to death. He returned to Mecca, but still had no great acceptance, until a group from a far distant town appealed to him to begin a community there. He left Mecca for the town called Yathrib. He was welcomed with open arms. So enthusiastic were the people there, they made him a ruler of the town and renamed it Medina, which is now the third most important shrine in Islam after Mecca and Jerusalem.
Mohammed was in his 50s when he began his ministry in Medina. Possibly because of the almost immediate and overwhelming acceptance he received there, his ambitions and goals took on much greater proportions than he had originally imagined. In Mecca, he called himself a prophet. In Medina, he called himself and was proclaimed by the people their ruler. Originally, he would have been satisfied with sobering up a small section of drunks in Mecca. Now he had grand plans. He was thinking in terms of all Arabia and beyond. His plan to unify the entire Arab world under Islam began.
He found it to his advantage to organize an army. His attitude changed altogether. When you read the teachings of Mohammed, they are almost a complete contradiction to his actions over this period of time. Whereas he preached peace and love, his exploits were militant. He developed into a military leader and even made a clause encouraging his groups to unconditional loyalty with the promise that they would go to heaven if they died in the service of Islam.
His main goal was Mecca. He was ruler over the second largest city in Arabia, but he would not be truly a leader of the Arabs until he was ruler of Mecca. He set the stage for battle against Mecca. He told his followers the greatest place of pilgrimage was Mecca. Every Muslim should go there on pilgrimage. When they complained that because they were his followers, their lives were in jeopardy if they pilgrimaged to Mecca, he vowed that he, their leader, would liberate Mecca and make it possible for them to worship at the shrine there.
He harassed the merchants at Mecca. He sent his soldiers on warring missions against the caravans that went from foreign countries to Mecca by way of Medina. Remember, he was a camel driver. He knew the routes that would be taken. He actually forced the people of Mecca to engage him in battle. Mecca declared war on Mohammed. They gave him justification to go after Mecca. His plan worked. He attacked Mecca with a vengeance. They were no match for him. You have to realize that most of the people of Mecca, especially the religious ones, were not violent. He stepped over many dead bodies to become the ruler of this country, and that was included in the Quran also. The Quran was actually written hands-on, adding and eliminating as he went along, based on his experience.
The next 10 years were to be his most formative. By the time he had died in 622, Islam ruled all of Arabia and many surrounding tribes. In addition to a large, well-oiled military machine, he had a thriving religious community going in Medina, with apostles and disciples chomping at the bit to get out there and evangelize. His long-range ambition manifested itself in a grand way. Before he died, Muhammad sent word to the Emperor of Rome to convert to Islam. He wrote to him, "Embrace Islam and God will reward you twofold. But if you refuse, O ye people of the book, beware. We are Muslim and our religion is Islam." The gauntlet had been thrown down.
Islam takes on the whole world. The growth of Islam in the 100 years after the death of Muhammad, from 622 to 732, was overwhelming. It almost defies logic. No one religion could have grown that quickly and taken over as much of the world as this one cult did. But why? What was the big attraction of Islam? We have to get into the climate of the times. The world situation was no different than it has been down through the centuries, when the power was with the few and the masses were under the domination of slavery and financial debt. No one seemed able or willing to care for the downtrodden. The wages were ridiculous, the interest rates were outrageous, and the taxes, on top of all of it, were impossible. People were drowning in their debts.
There was injustice, to be sure. Under these conditions, the time was ripe for Islam, who promised them relief from all their oppressions. His followers, as well as Muhammad, had been victims during their lifetimes of great social injustices. Muhammad told the people if they believed in Islam, their debts were forgiven. Usury was outlawed in countries ruled by Islam. Attorneys were available, courts were lenient, and judgments were in favor of the poor. But all of this was on paper. It was theoretical. Very often the slaves remained slaves and the poor remained poor and in debt, but because they had joined Islam, they thought they were free.
Just picture millions of people enslaved by debt all over the Arab world, given an immediate resolution to their problem, a blank check, so to speak. Join Islam and all your debts are forgiven, you are freed. And it was backed up with strong-arm tactics of his troops. Thus began Muhammad's dream of the conquest of the world by Islam. The Muslim conquest of all the Middle East and half of Europe in less than 100 years was a combination of Islam principles and sheer force. By 732, Islam had captured all of Arabia, North Africa, including Egypt and Libya, Spain, portions of Italy and France, as far north as Tours and Poitiers, which are approximately 150 miles from Paris. The Muslims went through countries like the barbarian hordes of earlier generations. One thing that marked the Muslims was their viciousness, their hostility, and their complete disregard for human life. That is, other than Muslim human life.
These principles still stand today in the Islamic code of ethics. One of the rules of Islam is that one Muslim cannot harm another Muslim, but any Muslim who kills a non-Muslim is rewarded by Allah. This has changed somewhat in the past generation. In the 1980s and 90s, the Iranians and Iraqis were at war for 8 years. The death toll was horrendous. Then we can't forget Saddam Hussein's foray into Kuwait and the atrocities which took place there, and his wholesale annihilation of his own people, the Kurds, in the north. Nothing has changed in 1,500 years with the followers of Muhammad other than now they are more willing to kill their own. The Muslims just swallowed up countries. After the movement had spread throughout the Arab world, Islam set their sights on the rest of the world, the non-Islam world. Invasion to the north and the west was the key word. At one point in history, Spain and Portugal were ruled by Muslims for 700 years, as was Yugoslavia and Greece. Sicily was under Muslim domination for almost 300 years.
One of the greatest clashes between Christianity and Islam took place in the form of the Crusades. Pope Urban II called a crusade to stop the ever-moving onslaught of the Muslims. The immediate defense in 1095 was Constantinople, which was in imminent danger of being taken over by the Turks, who were Muslim. The Crusades made as part of their quest the liberation of the holy places in Palestine, which had been desecrated by the Muslims for centuries. The appeal of our Pope and holy people from all parts of Europe so touched the faithful that a highly emotional, unorganized group of 50,000 literally ran to the defense of the Holy Land. Old people, children, whole families, everyone stepped forward to dedicate their lives to the liberation of the holy places. It was called the People's Crusade. Most of them never made it past Constantinople. Those who did set foot on the shores of Palestine were slaughtered in short order.
But within a few years of this effort, organized troops of crack military troops from Europe, led by their kings or princes or head military men, began the Crusades as we know them today. At the beginning, they were brilliant. It was as if the Lord himself were at the helm. They captured Jerusalem from the Saracens after 40 days. The Crusades lasted for just about 200 years. In 1291, the last of the Crusaders were thrown out of the Holy Land. They did leave their mark there, however. To this day, there is a small but strong group of Christian community occupying pockets of influence in various areas of the Holy Land, such as Bethlehem. The next strong onslaught of the Muslims on Christianity took place when the Turks, under the leadership of Osman, created the Ottoman Empire, which ruled a great portion of the Christian world with an iron fist for hundreds of years.
We once said that all wars are religious wars. The more we see what is going on in the world around us, we believe more than ever the truth of that statement. On a very broad scale, Christians and Muslims, the two largest and most powerful religious groups in the world, have been at war with each other for almost 1,300 years. There has never really been a bond of peaceful coexistence between Muslims and Christians.
The church fights back. For every splinter of the cross, there is a triumph of the cross. Jesus made a promise to us that he would not leave us orphans. He would be with us always until the end of time. While we can't get into detailed stories of each of the ways God has fought the Muslim heresy over the last 1,300 years and continues to fight it, we can tell you that there have been miracles of the Eucharist that have come about. The saints our Lord has raised to combat this heresy, and the apparitions of Our Lady made to help us. St. Francis of Assisi rose up at a time to turn the Muslim epidemic around and convert the Sultan. The Holy House of Nazareth was saved from destruction by the angels and brought to Loreto, Italy. In Langenwies, Czechoslovakia, a miracle of the Eucharist was instrumental in turning the tide of the Turks at Belgrade in 1456.
We truly believe that the Lord has a teaching for us in everything that goes on in the world. Historians and military leaders throughout the centuries have been instructed by their predecessors. Caesar copied Alexander the Great, Napoleon copied Caesar, Hitler copied all three. We see a resurgence today in the power and aggressiveness of the Muslim Arab world. We see European leaders mimicking their forerunners of 50 years ago, reacting with fear and intimidation of the tactics of Arab terrorists with the same philosophy they used in dealing with Adolf Hitler. If we ignore him, he'll go away, they thought. If we appease him, he'll leave us alone, they prayed. Deep down in our hearts, we know that will never work. There is only one way to deal with this type of enemy: heavy-duty prayer and fasting.
Where do we go from here? Communism is no longer the number one threat in the world. Militant Islam is the number one threat in the world, declared Colonel John O'Connor, Archbishop of New York, during his commencement speech at St. Thomas Aquinas College in Ojai, California, in June of 1989, which was written up by the Tidings, the diocesan newspaper of Los Angeles. He shared that the spread of militant Islam, as expressed by the late Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran, is a very, very fearsome thing. He further stated that Islam is sweeping the world faster than any other religion. He projected figures which showed that by the year 2000, which is right around the corner, Christianity will be only the second largest religion. Islam will have the most adherents. There are those who say this has already come to pass. This shouldn't surprise us that much, although it should put the fear of God into us. From the time the Muslims made their big push into Christian Europe in 732 A.D., until the forward movement of the Turks was finally stopped at the end of the 17th century, beginning with the evacuation of the Crimean states, every Vatican Council focused on the growing Muslim problem. They have always been a major threat to the Church as well as to the world.
Time magazine printed an article on May 13, 1988, which stated that by the year 2000, the second largest religion in the United States, grouping all Christianity together as number one, that means Catholics and all denominations of Protestants are lumped as one group, will be Muslim. That's not true any longer. It is now predicted that Muslim will be the greatest, with all Christianity placed together as second. There are an estimated 4,644,000 Muslims in the United States, with the largest concentration being in the state of California. There are more than 600 Islamic centers throughout the United States, with many more planned.
In a relatively small American town, Dearborn, Michigan, where there is a 10-15% Muslim representation, Muslim holy days are observed. We can't get Catholic holy days observed anywhere in the United States, and yet these people have been able to accomplish that. The girls' dress code in the public school gym class has been modified to coincide with Muslim religious customs. In addition, no pork, which is against Muslim dietetic law, is served in the school cafeterias. Muslims are receiving greater and greater religious considerations, and Christians cannot pray in school because of separation of church and state.
The situation that you may find shocking is by no means limited to the United States. Most European countries are finding that their Muslim population is increasing rapidly, as is the voice of the Muslims in these countries. Do I have a problem with this? It frightens me. The prospect of living under any kind of Muslim domination in a country, a world, where I cannot worship Jesus except with a price on my head, puts me in a panic.
Jesus is trying to get our attention. Listen to him. Listen to Mother Mary. She's been running all over the world trying to get our attention. There's no more time. We must get on with it. Do whatever he tells you. We love you.
Thank you for tuning in today for Bob and Penny Lord's Scandal of the Cross. For more information, call Journeys of Faith, toll free at 1-800-633-2484.